We're here with Dr. Susan Albertine, Assistant Provost at Temple University. This is Children Come First with Dr. Daria Brzezinski. And we're talking a little bit about Temple University and higher education and the direction of higher education. Let's talk about we talked about undergraduate, and I never really got to graduate work. Mm-hmm. First of all, you have 17 schools. What are some of those schools of learning?
Well, I could give you the whole list, but I'll give you some examples. We have the College of Liberal Arts, which is a college where we have the disciplines of the humanities and the social sciences. So you'd have sociology there, English, modern languages, classical languages. We also have criminal justice there. That's all in the and psychology in the College of Liberal Arts. We have also the College of Science and Technology. And that's where you'd find the natural sciences, mathematics, and a computer and information sciences. Those are two very large colleges. We have the Fox School of Business and Management, which is our business school. We have a School of Tourism and Hospitality Management, which is a very much applied program, industry-directed and driven. It's an undergraduate program that has a strong business component, but it's obviously designed to serve that particular sector of the workplace. We have the Tyler School of Art. And the Tyler School of Art includes a program in architecture. The Esther Boyer College, which is music, and that would include, I'm giving you just a kind of overview. We have 120 majors, by the way, so there are lots of them. But that gives you a few of the colleges.
My goodness, that's an awful lot of majors.
It's extraordinary, and I think it's one of the things that sets Temple apart from other universities. It also... Because we have so many majors and so many colleges, you have the chance to be part of a smaller community when you're in a very large university. And I think you would be hard-pressed to find more programs. You know, we have the Allied Health, the College of Allied Health, which is nursing and health information management and occupational therapy, as well as physical therapy, though physical therapy is a graduate program. And then we have all the benefits that come to us from being a university that has a large health system and medical school complex and a dental school, school of podiatric medicine, and a school of pharmacy. Those are not all undergraduate programs, but their existence is important and it enriches the undergraduate programs. I'll give you one example. We have a lot of activity now at Temple in the neurosciences. Scientists in the neurosciences could be placed in many different schools and colleges, from the medical school to psychology in the College of Liberal Arts. And they're studying the science of the brain, the science of mind. It's a very, very important field right now. And we have undergraduate concentrations in the neurosciences so that you can actually, as an undergraduate, work in a path-breaking new interdisciplinary field. And it's richer because we have a medical school and we have people from the medical school who are working in the neurosciences. So that's a real advantage to a big university.
That's simply amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think we are, it's, higher education has so many options for students, and I think it's important to understand that coming in. We have, within Temple, colleges that would look like small colleges. They're their own units, really. But then they're connected together in the larger whole.
How many students are there at Temple?
Well, if you count graduate students and undergraduate students and full and part-time students, we're around 28,000 right now.
Hmm. Is this Temple a state school or
it's
is it a private?
It's a state-related university.
And what does that mean?
That means that we are public, that we get a certain share of our funding from a state appropriation. So we're a public university. It's the structure of public institutions in Pennsylvania is a little different from the structure in other states. And we have four universities that are what they call state-related. We get a substantial amount of support from the state. Temple is one of them. University of Pittsburgh, Lincoln, and Penn State, the other. Then we have the state system of higher education, which has Bloomsburg and Westchester and some of the other universities in Pennsylvania that are part of what they call the SHEHE system. That's the state system.
How have teaching and learning changed over the last decade? We've had all different sorts of models, and I'm talking about teaching in the sense of at the college level.
Well, the biggest change, I would say, in the undergraduate area has to do with what people call a paradigm shift, and that's a I'm talking about something that you could think of as a sea change, a real change in the way we're thinking. And the shift is this, the paradigm change is this, from an emphasis on teaching to an emphasis on learning. And that'll be familiar with you because you've been involved in school reform and looking at different models for K-12 learning. But that shift in emphasis from teaching to learning is really critical. If you think of it this way, imagine a student as an empty vessel to fill, and you, the teacher, have knowledge and you sort of pour that knowledge into the student's brain. That is a something of a caricature of the traditional model, but it's the student receiving the knowledge from the professor or from the teacher. That's a teaching model. A different model is the learning model, in which you concentrate on what the student knows and is able to do. So it's not as if you pay no attention to teaching. You pay a huge amount of attention to teaching, but what you're mostly attending to is what the student can do, rather than what you are putting into the student's head. The change is really significant. It begins to make us question how we give grades, how we decide what learning means. The shift in emphasis from teaching to learning tends to move you toward an understanding of learning as an experience that requires a certain performance, tends to move you away from lists of facts to be memorized and more toward performance of activities that show mastery or competency within a certain area. That's, I guess, my best quick description of the big change in higher education, and I do think you'll see that K-16, kindergarten through the baccalaureate level around the country.
You have basically summarized my last 60 programs in a few sentences.
Oh, good. Well, I hope that was helpful.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
That change is coming related to what I said about the neurosciences. In the last 25, 30 years, there's been an incredible growth in what we know about the mind and about learning. And that the new developments in the science of learning and in the neurosciences are beginning to affect pedagogy. That is the way we teach. And you're seeing that. Interestingly, in the same period of time, we have widespread adoption of computers. And computers often can be used to enhance learning. So you had the right sort of conditions for a revolutionary change to be taking place in the classroom.
What has amazed me tremendously is the fact that, as you know, some of us, my group, has spent the last almost 30 years now doing something on instinct, creating models of education on instinct, and all of a sudden now the latest brain research has caught up with our model. And here we've had an existing model for 30 years that correlates with the latest research.
Sure.
So it makes me ecstatic.
Yes.
What, now that we've gone through basically the differences in learning styles and in teaching styles, how does that relate to the differences that happen on campus and in campus life?
Okay, well, let me...
Well, not just the learning styles, but the fact that, you know, we're doing distance learning and technology, and is campus different than it was when I was in school? I won't tell you how many years ago.
Yes. Let me give you one or two examples that I think will help to illustrate the change. If you're concentrating on learning, you're concentrating on experience, Well, there's a whole realm of learning there, experiential learning. That's a big category or rubric under which you can place certain kinds of activities that might happen on a college campus. One of those activities we're calling service learning. Now, this is not just at Temple. We happen to be extremely active in service learning at Temple, but you can find service learning all around the country in universities. So what does service learning mean in a traditional discipline where you're seeing that there's some kind of change taking place in emphasis from teaching to learning? Well, maybe within the English major, you have a service learning component of several courses within the major. And in those service learning courses, the students might be involved in work outside the classroom, perhaps in the community, perhaps in Temple's case in North Philadelphia, working on literacy projects. And those literacy projects could be undertaken at a community center, at a school, at a nursing home. And they could involve production of a neighborhood newspaper or magazine or an online journal. Or they might involve teaching the basics of literacy to seniors, recent immigrants for whom English is a second language. The students who are involved in that work don't just go and do the service. They actually reflect on it and make it part of the classroom learning so that you might, in fact, be studying literacy as a topic within an English course. And that kind of learning is taking place across the curriculum in fields that you might not have thought were going to be doing that sort of thing. And I think, you know, English is a good example. But you might find the same going on in a math course. And, of course, that would work in nicely with teacher training. But it just as easily could be part of the regular math program.
So basically what you're teaching is community service.
Well, yes, but there's got to be, it's more than the service. There's the idea that the students, the college students in the class, reflect on the service experience and that it is integral to the learning of the classroom. So if you have some kind of course, it could be in journalism, for example, and which you're learning the basics of journalism, there might be a community outreach component in which you are out practicing what you learn by working with a community group. Or in a political science class, you might be out working with a campaign and coming back and reflecting on what you've learned. Say you're studying political theory and you're actually engaged in campaign work. We do, in fact, have a program that does this. You can then take what you're learning in your books, in your classroom, in lectures, or on the internet, and see what it means in practice. It's the idea of an internship, but it's an internship that's designed in a different way with service in mind and with reflection as part of it. That's just one example, but I think it's a very important example, and I believe we've got about 60 different classes going on right now that have service learning components in the undergraduate programs at Temple.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Dr. Susan Albertine from Temple University. If you'd like to reach her, you may call her at 215-204-2044. That's 215-204-2044. Or you can call us here at toll-free 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. I'd really like to continue with this difference between teaching and learning because I think it's important for people to understand that there is a real shift going on here as far as education goes. What other components can you talk about in the learning process besides for service learning that's different from traditional teaching?
We have been working on a project. This is actually not something I am organizing centrally as vice provost. I'm actually not assistant provost, I'm vice provost, but it's close enough.
Pardon me.
I work with the schools and colleges on programs when they ask me to help facilitate or to relate their work to something that's university-wide. what's been happening in some of the traditional majors that were in the College of Liberal Arts and the College of Science and Technology, which really did come out of their college, was a plan to develop sets of competencies for each of the majors. So that in sociology, if you complete a baccalaureate degree, a bachelor's degree in sociology, you will have achieved some things that you can know in advance. And this is a new kind of activity for faculty. It means sitting down with the faculty and asking this question: what do we expect our students to know, and what do we expect them to be able to do when they finish this major? We started that work a couple of years back. It's had an enormous influence. That kind of change will be continuing over time. Right now, of course, we are relying on grades and on credit units to show what students have learned. But once you start talking about competencies, you begin to suggest that there may be additional ways to know what students have learned. And maybe you want to demonstrate it through performance, or maybe you want to have something like a portfolio. So in addition to a grade, they can actually show you what they've done. And this is related to the work of experiential learning, the influence of an emphasis on learning in the classroom. We aren't there yet, but we do have capstone courses in each of the majors that are supposed to provide students. They're designed to provide students with an opportunity to demonstrate what they've learned in that field. Now, that's different, and that's extremely important. It's also much closer to what you're going to find in the workplace. People perform in the workplace. They achieve. They show the results of their work. They don't work for grades. They work to get a salary and to get increases, but they have to produce and to show mastery of tasks. And you're seeing that throughout the curriculum. There's also, I guess, a corresponding growth of interest in research and research that's involving undergraduates. So we look for opportunities to bring undergraduates into laboratories. Likewise, we discover that undergraduate students can be extremely good peer tutors, peer teachers. They can work in academic enrichment centers, like our Writing Center or our Math Science Resource Center, in activities that we call supplemental instruction. Well, there's nothing like helping somebody else to learn to enrich your own understanding. Those activities are very, very important here, and we have large numbers of students flocking to our academic enrichment centers where they can work sometimes online, where they can work in small groups, with peer tutors, and with professional staff and faculty. That's pushing learning outside of the classroom in some very important ways. So as I see it, there's a connection here between the shift in emphasis from teaching to learning to the everyday life that students are experiencing on the classroom. The learning is moving outside of the classroom or outside of the box, and it's taking place in a variety of venues and modes. It's all, in my mind, all related to a new way that we have come to understand undergraduate experience.
This must be terribly frightening to academics professors who have been in the traditional mentality for 20 years. This is a very different way of thinking about students and the way they learn, and it must be very frightening because it lacks the control issues of testing and the traditional kinds of setup that we've had in our schools.
Well, I wouldn't say that that's true across the board. What you have to remember is that faculty are, in many cases, choosing to try out new modes of teaching and learning. That academic freedom continues to matter hugely on a college campus, and that faculty have opportunities to decide where and how they want to engage with change. What I've found is that some of the innovators are among our most senior faculty. if you look at some of our faculty who've done innovative work online, for example, you're going to find people in their 50s and 60s. Now, that's not always going to be the case, but it often is the case, we discover. There's a reason that I can give for that. I don't know that it's an adequate reason, but it's a start. You're a professor. You come out of a graduate school. You have to publish. You have to do some traditional things. And your promotion, your tenure, will depend on your achievement of a certain degree of excellence in scholarship. That looks pretty traditional. You don't have a whole lot of time to experiment. Once you've gotten tenure, once you are able to branch out and try other things, you may find that you have a little more freedom to experiment with teaching, with learning, with service. And so it isn't altogether surprising to me that some of our senior faculty have been leaders in change.
That's wonderful. Maybe it's time to rethink how we give people tenure, for example.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think today already on campus I've had that conversation twice. Particularly faculty who are developing online or mediated courses, distributed learning courses, what sort of credit do they get when it's time for promotion and time for tenure. Those are decisions made by the faculty, and faculty are now discussing that here. You know, how much weight ought traditional scholarship to have, and should that change? Is it going to change quickly? I can't tell you that it's going to change quickly, but in some of our schools and colleges at Temple, it is changing.
What sets Temple apart from everyone else? Why would our listening audience choose to go to Temple than Penn State or a smaller, one of the Sheehy schools or a community college? What does Temple offer that it sets it apart from the others?
Well, I can think of several things. One, the fact that we're able to offer so many programs. For undergraduates, about 120 majors. You're going to have to look long and hard to find that. Second, the fact that we are in an urban setting and we're in a city. And the city is extremely attractive for students right now. We have such an increase in applicants and entering students. Our numbers have gone way up. And that's because students are figuring out that living and studying in a city is a road to opportunity. So the combination of being a great research university, which we are, with a huge range of selection of academic programs in a city, and the fact that we're public, to all of those factors together, I think, set us apart. And we are one of the truly diverse in every way, diverse in people, diverse in programs, universities in the country, and that's something of which we're very proud.
Being a country girl, how is living in the city an opportunity?
It's an opportunity because you get a sense of the changing workforce. The city and its immediate environment is attractive to business and to global commerce. And so you have a chance to study in a city that is a center of economic development in a world that is diverse, racially and ethnically diverse, so that the workplace that you're in, your study place, looks like the workplace of the future. I think that's important, and students are telling us that that's important. The world is shrinking. You know, we expect to travel. We expect to be with people from many different backgrounds. And where can you right now find those conditions? Well, you're going to find them in a city, at a metropolitan campus.
When you accept students from rural areas into city, for example, much of Pennsylvania is rural.
Yes.
Do they have difficulty in transitioning from rural life to city life?
Well,
our
experience is that we can't put up dormitories fast enough. Students want to come here, and we have residential programs that are meant to serve them, beginning with orientation. And so for students who are making a transition to the city life, we have what they need. We have also a suburban campus in Ambler, and there are residence halls at Ambler, and some students who are coming from rural areas find that a comfortable way to begin. I find the Temple campus attractive and safe. I talk to parents about that all the time. We've been very thoughtful in the way we respond to families' concerns about life in the city. This is a very safe campus. It's a very comfortable campus, and we take student life seriously. The fact that our students in unprecedented numbers are asking to stay in the dormitories, they want to stay, they want to live on campus, is telling us we're doing something right. If we only had enough housing to accommodate the demand, that would be even better. We're putting up a new dormitory now.
I'm speaking from experience, having lived in Philadelphia for a while, and how has the urban area changed in the last 10 years to allow for this? I also took courses at Temple downtown. Mm-hmm. How has the environment changed so that it is safer for students to come?
Well, on our main campus, we have so many students out and around day and night because it's well lighted, because we've got classes going in the evening, so students are in and out, because we have the new Leocurus Center, which is a center for conferences and athletic events and entertainment. So there's a kind of social, cultural richness of the campus. We have always had concerts going on the campus at night, and as well as classes and athletic events. So there's a lot happening that's attracting business in the immediate area. We're seeing some development around Temple and hearing more plans of businesses that would like to come in and shops that would like to come in. The fact that we've put up new dormitories and have more residential students has, of course, changed things, too, because that's attracting vendors. And it's also attracting the students who don't live on campus to stay around in the evening because there are things happening like poetry reading. So you end up with the kind of activity that just doesn't stop, that characterizes a metropolitan college campus. It's very exciting.
It is, and I wish you continued success. In our last few minutes here, is there anything you'd like to say to our audience to sum up whatever you would like to regarding Temple?
Sure. I think this is an amazingly interesting time to be a college student. I think that we have opportunities now on college campuses to grow and change in ways that we never have before. As I look around the country and talk to colleagues at colleges and universities across the country, I've become convinced that the place to look for the most important changes now for preparation for the future of our workforce and of our intellectual life in this society that we say is driven by knowledge are the great public universities. Temple is one of those, and we're very proud to be there. So I urge people to take a look at the university and to think about what it means to be a lifelong learner at a university that's taking that kind of learning seriously.
We'd like to thank Dr. Susan Albertine from Temple University, who's Vice Provost. And if you'd like to reach her at any point, you may call her at 215-204-2044. That's 215-204-2044. Or you can get on the internet at Temple University and temple.edu or nimbus.temple.edu and search her out there. We'd like to thank her for visiting us today at Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. You may reach us toll-free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. Or you may email us at PROKIDS@RLC.net. That's PROKIDS@RLC.net. We'd like to invite you to join us again for our next program, when we'll be talking to someone interesting and regarding children and our future. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you again to Dr. Susan Albertine from Temple University.
Thanks so much, Daria. That was very enjoyable.